Probably the most famous Sherwood Forester that ever lived was General Smith Dorrien. He was educated at Harrow and he joined the 95th Regiment of Foot, which had become the Derbyshire Regiment in 1825. At the start of World War I, he was selected by Lord Kitchener to command the British Second Corps when they fought at the Battle of Mons. His finest hour came the day after, at a place called Le Cateau, when British troops were retreating from Mons, hotly pursued by a huge German army. He decided to ignore General French's orders to retreat and made a heroic stand at Le Cateau, with a brief comment to all his soldiers that has gone down in history. "Gentlemen, we will fight." This rearguard action checked the German advance and actually saved the British army. But going back many years before that, on the 22nd of January 1879, he was present in the Zulu Wars and actually took part in the Battle of Isandlwana, which was the slaughter of British soldiers literally the day before the Battle of Rorke's Drift, which I'm sure you've all seen on that incredible film with Stanley Baker and Michael Caine, Zulu. Amazingly enough, there were three members of the 95th Regiment of Foot involved with the Zulu Wars and Isandlwana. The commander of the British Army, Lord Chelmsford, had actually been colonel of the 95th Foot at the end of the Indian Mutiny. Lieutenant Colonel Creelock was actually on Lord Chelmsford's staff, and he became the first colonel of the 2nd Battalion of the Sherwood Foresters. Lieutenant Smith Dorrien was in charge of the transport depot at Rorke's Drift and had been warned before starting that he should have to return there at once from Isandlwana with a convoy of empty wagons to bring up more stores. So he actually left his kit, his camp kit, in a tented wagon at Rorke's Drift. At about midnight, he says, "I was sent for by General Lord Chelmsford and told to take a dispatch back to Rorke's Drift for Lieutenant Colonel Durnford, who was expected there with reinforcements consisting of native levies. I rode back 10 miles, arriving at Rorke's Drift just before dawn on the 22nd of January and delivered my dispatch. I had several arrangements to make for transport at Rorke's Drift, amongst others, the erection of a gallows. But after starting the gallows, I went up to see Lieutenant Bromhead," who of course was played by Michael Caine in the film Zulu. "He was in command of a company of the 24th Regiment of Foot, and I told him that a big fight was expected and that I wanted some revolver ammunition. Lieutenant Bromhead and Lieutenant Chard were awarded Victoria Crosses for their defence at Rorke's Drift. Bromhead gave me 11 rounds of ammunition, and hearing heavy guns over at Isandlwana, I rode off and got into that camp about 8 a.m, just as Colonel Durnford's force arrived. Nothing of importance occurred beyond the constant increase of the Zulus and spreading out of their Zulu horns until about 11 o'clock, when they started their forward movement directed on the camp. Our troops were in the positions they had occupied hours before, our two guns busy throughout shelling the enemy. 45 empty wagons stood in the camp with the oxen in. It was a convoy which I was supposed to have taken back to Rorke's Drift for supplies early in the morning, which was stopped until, what they believed, the enemy should be driven off. These wagons might at any time been formed into a lager." And that's not a pint of beer. A lager was a little bit similar to, if anybody ever remembers the film Wagon Train. Basically what happened was, if the Indians were going to attack, you put your wagons into a circle and you fired at them from inside, which was a very good fortification. Had that have been done at Isandlwana, then the British army would have beaten the Zulus. "But unfortunately," he says, "no one appeared to appreciate the gravity of the situation. So much so that no steps were taken until too late to issue extra ammunition from the large reserves we had in the camp, and no one ever discussed the idea of lagering the wagons. When I had been engaged for some time and the 2nd Battalion of the 24th had fallen back to where we were, with the Zulus following closely, Bloomfield, the quartermaster of the 2nd Battalion of the 24th, said to me in regard to the boxes that I was breaking open for ammunition, "For heaven's sake, man, don't take that, because it belongs to our battalion." And I yelled back at him, "Hang it all. You don't want a requisition for this now, do you?" To return to the fight, our right flank had become enveloped by the horn of the Zulus and their levies were flying before them. And the transport drivers, panic-stricken, were jostling each other with their teams and wagons, shouting and yelling at their cattle and striving to get over the neck on the road to Rorke's Drift. And the red line of the 2nd Battalion 24th, having fixed bayonets, appeared to have but one idea, and that was to defeat the enemy. When the final charge took place, the transport, which was in spanned, had mostly cleared the neck. When the final charge took place, I jumped on my broken-kneed pony, which had no rest for 30 hours, and followed the fleeing soldiers. I shall never forget, for some 4,000 Zulus had come in behind and were busy with shields and assegais, that's spears. Into this mass I rode, revolver in hand, right through the Zulus, but they completely ignored me. I heard afterwards that they had been told by their king, Cetshwayo, that black coats were civilians and were not worth killing. They only killed soldiers in red coats. And I had a blue patrol jacket on. And it is noticeable that the only 5 officers who escaped had on blue coats. The Zulus throughout my escape seemed to be set on killing natives who had sided with us, either as fighting levies or transport drivers. The ground was terribly bad going, all rocks and boulders, and it was about 3 or 4 miles from camp to Fugitives Drift. When approaching this drift, and at least half a mile behind, Coghill and Lieutenant Melville, who were carrying the regimental colours, in a red coat with a case colour across the front of his saddle, passed me going to the drift. I then came to Fugitive Drifts myself, the descent to which was almost a precipice. I found there a man in a red coat, badly assegaied, speared in the arm and unable to move. He was, I believe, a mounted infantryman of the 24th named MacDonald, but of his name I cannot be sure. I managed to make a tourniquet with a handkerchief to stop the bleeding and got him halfway down when a shout from behind said, "Get on, man, the Zulus are on top of you." I turned round and saw Major Smith, Royal Artillery, who was commanding the section of guns, as white as a sheet and bleeding profusely. And in a second we were surrounded, and spears accounted for poor Smith, my wounded friend, and my horse. With the help of my revolver and a wild jump down the rocks, I found myself in the Buffalo River, which was in flood and 80 yards wide. I was carried away, but luckily got hold of the tail of a loose horse, which towed me across to the other bank, but I was too exhausted to stick to him. Up this bank were swarming friendly natives, but I only saw one European, a colonel and acting commissariat officer named Hammer, lying there unable to move. I managed to catch a loose horse and put him on it, and he escaped. The Zulus were pouring in a very heavy fire from the opposite bank and dropped several friendly natives as we climbed to the top. No sooner had I achieved this than I saw a lot of Zulus had crossed higher up and were running to cut me off. This drove me off to my left, but 20 of them still pursued me for about 3 miles, and I managed to keep them off with my revolver. I eventually got to safety at a place called Heltmakar at sundown, having done 20 miles on foot from the river. At Heltmakar, I found Huntley of the 10th, who had been left there with a small garrison, and also Essex, Cochrane, Curling and Gardner from the field of Isandlwana, all busily placing posts in a state of defence. I at once took command of one face of the laager, which they'd created at Heltmakar, which they should have done at Isandlwana, and shall never forget how pleased we weary wretches were when shortly upon midnight a major of the 24th with 2 companies arrived. They had started for Rorke's Drift that afternoon and they had been turned back by Major Holding, a staff officer, as he said Rorke's Drift had been surrounded and captured. Such is briefly my story of the 22nd of January, 1879, and I have endeavoured to avoid personal incidents as far as possible, though I should like my sons to know that on the evidence of eyewitnesses, I was recommended for the Victoria Cross for two separate acts on that day. These recommendations drew laudatory letters from the War Office with a regret that as the proper channels for a correspondence had not been observed, the statutes of the Victoria Cross did not admit of my receiving that distinction. And having no friends at court, the matter was dropped. But in view of my latest experiences during the First World War, I am sure that decision was right. For any trivial act of good Samaritanism I may have performed that day would not have earned a military cross, much less than a Victoria Cross, amidst the deeds of real heroism that I saw performed during the Great War of 1914 to 1918.